This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
It's getting hot in here. Megan Hassett of the Union of Concerned Scientists says global climate change will make a big difference in central Illinois.
Right here in McLean County, we'll see going from 6 days of experiencing 100 degrees Fahrenheit of heat index days, going from 6 to 67 by the end of the century on average.
Eric Stock has more. Plus, the Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development is 25 years old. Mary Cullen looks at the anniversary. And WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, looks at food free for the taking, the rules of foraging on Grow.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
If you enjoy listening to WGLT podcasts, now is the time to help pay for it. This week is the WGLT Fall Fund Drive. Add your voice now at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Union of Concerned Scientists has published a new report that presents a stark choice about substantive action to reduce greenhouse gases or watching temperatures rising to potentially dangerous levels. The group's Megan Hassett and Illinois State University Geology Professor Catherine O'Reilly are two of the presenters at a climate change conversation called It's Getting Hot in Here, tomorrow night at First United Methodist Church in Normal. Hassett tells WGLT's Eric Stock the group's study breaks down temperature change projections for each county in the country.
The extreme heat that we've been seeing is definitely on the rise, and it's on track to get a whole lot hotter right in our lifetimes. We analyzed a couple different scenarios based on levels of global emissions. So what we actually found was that if we take no action to reduce global emissions, right here in McLean County, we'll see going from 6 days of experiencing 100 degrees Fahrenheit of heat index days, going from 6 to 67 by the end of the century on average. And then we'll actually be seeing for days where it's a heat index of 105 degrees Fahrenheit or more, going from 3 days historically to 49. We'll also be seeing off the charts days. The National Weather Service can't even calculate accurately right now. But if we do take rapid action, we'll still be seeing a large increase. But if we limit global warming emissions and the global temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels, we'll see instead more like 17 days of a heat index over 105 degrees Fahrenheit, 31 days with a heat index of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. So still a big increase, but less than half of what we would see otherwise.
How do those trends compare with what we've seen over the last 30 to 50 years in reverse? In other words, is this an increase in temperature acceleration that much more than what we've seen up to this point?
That's a great question. Our study did not really look at how the trends have changed over the last couple decades. It took more of a historical average of the last 35 years or so, looking at and set that as sort of a baseline of historical experiences, and then looked really using climate models to analyze what would happen from here on out.
So, Catherine O'Reilly, how does this fit in with the historical trends from what you've studied?
Yeah, so what we know about extreme heat events is that they were really pretty rare 50 years ago. There'd be occasional ones, but they wouldn't be very common. And so as things seem to have gotten warmer, for example, July 2019 is the hottest month on Earth ever that we've recorded, scientists have compared these recent heat waves and tried to see how much more are they happening more frequently now than they used to. And for example, in Europe, the recent heat waves the past few years in 2017 and in 2019, those are 10 to 100 times more likely now than they were in the early 1900s. So there's a lot of evidence that these high, really extreme warm events are happening 10 times or even more than 10 times more frequently than they used to.
And going back to central Illinois, for an area that is so heavily dependent on agriculture, weather, of course, is critical. And farmers have been dealing with weather extremes with increasing regularity. What might this mean for them?
I think it's going to be very challenging for our agricultural sector to start thinking about how to adapt to climate change. The kinds of changes we've seen this year with the extreme wet spring, that's exactly what we're projected and predicted to get more of and see more common. And this particular year, it really had major impacts on when planting could occur, and everything got really far behind. And then, if you're crop planting is late, you really need ideal conditions moving forward to get that crop to mature in time. And then, of course, we've had some really, even in Illinois this summer, we've had some really warm days, and that stresses the crops and means that your production's not going to be as good.
Other populations more impacted than others when it comes to heat are children and the elderly. Also, those without air conditioning. How much of an impact will this have as the trend continues in this direction?
Well, we're definitely going to see increases in heat-related deaths. Already, heat is one of the major contributors to natural causes of death associated with weather. So this is going to be affecting primarily the young children and the elderly, who are just much more susceptible to heat and less able to sort of regulate their physiological responses. And then the other sort of group that's going to be really affected are people who work outside. And so this is really a wide range of people who might be from construction workers to agriculture. And all of these people are going to be much more susceptible to the problems that being exposed to high heat causes.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Catherine O'Reilly, geology professor at Illinois State University, and Megan Hassett, Midwest Campaign Coordinator for the Climate and Energy Program with the Union of Concerned Scientists, two of those who will be among the presenters at a public discussion on Thursday entitled It's Getting Hot in Here, from 6 to 8 p.m. at First United Methodist Church in Normal. And let's get into the why, Megan. We know this, of course, is caused by greenhouse gases trapping the heat. What are we doing that is exacerbating the problem most in order of priority?
Sure. So generally speaking, our use of fossil fuels is the main emitter of carbon global warming emissions that has been accelerating this problem of heat trapping emissions in our atmosphere, driving this extreme heat increases. And we know that there's a couple big sectors where this is coming from. One of the biggest right now is transportation, as well as our electric power sector, sort of our grid where we get our lights and sometimes our heat from. And then there's heating as well. But transportation and energy and electricity are definitely the biggest places where we have an opportunity to reduce emissions very quickly and hopefully achieve that best case scenario where we see a limited increase in these extreme heat occurrences.
And green advocates are pushing for the Clean Energy Jobs Act in Illinois. This will be part of the discussion on Thursday. Citizens Utility Board is one of the groups that has been advocating for this measure. Catherine, how would this help sort of stem the tide of climate change?
Well, we really have two options in front of us. We can adapt to the changes that we're seeing, and that's sort of planning for the inevitable, like in this case, making sure that there's good access to cool spaces for people in the summer, education about the symptoms and how to manage working in high heat conditions. And then the other option is mitigation. And for that, those are doing things, changing how we live in ways that reduce how much greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere, or removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere so that we reduce the amount of warming that's occurring.
And from what I understand, the proposal would also implement market reforms to electricity, a measure that is intended to lower power bills?
Yes. So this bill would be putting Illinois in a path to 100% renewable electricity by 2050. So that includes big investments into renewable sources like wind and solar. And this also would lower electricity bills, because we've been seeing with these programs like Solar for All and energy efficiency programs, we can pass on cost savings to consumers from shifting away from fossil fuels, as long as we're making sure that it's equitable and that all communities can really access those benefits.
The Illinois Chamber of Commerce has weighed in on this, as I imagine you might have heard. They're disputing claims that it would lead to lower energy costs, and they call it, quote, fear-mongering, an attempt to scare legislators and the public into making rash decisions about their energy consumption. How do you respond to that?
Sure. So I think something like this extreme heat report that Union of Concerned Scientists put out really underscores the urgency for action to rapidly reduce emissions. And we simply, you know, as Catherine said, we definitely need resilience, and we need to protect those who are most at risk from these extreme heat and other kinds of impacts. But we also need to make sure that we're doing as much as we can, as fast as we can, to preserve a recognizable future for our children. So that means doing things and using technologies that we already have here and now, tapping into the falling costs of wind and solar compared to the increasing inefficiencies of relying on coal power. We've already seen that those who are, you know, getting power from coal are actually shutting those plants down because they're simply uneconomic. So those trends will continue, and I think it's really time to reinvest in communities, reinvest in wind and solar, and I think that way we can actually tap into those falling costs.
And there's really no reason not to, right? I mean, if we were to do something like that and it turned out that it didn't work for some reason, we have a fallback plan. We could just go back to what we're doing right now.
As we continue on Sound Ideas with Catherine O'Reilly and Meggett Hassett, two of the presenters at an upcoming discussion in Normal called It's Getting Hot in Here at First United Methodist Church. Catherine, can you give me an overview of who all will be presenting at this event?
Sure. So, yeah, this event happening right at the First United Methodist Church, we'll have a number of speakers. We've been working with the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition to put together these events all across the state. And here in Normal, we'll be talking with myself and Professor O'Reilly. We'll also be hearing from Kate York with Citizens Utility Board. We'll be hearing from Amanda Pankow with Prairie Rivers Network, as well as Reverend Pierce. And it'll be a great community discussion starting around 6:30 with a reception at 6 p.m.
There seems to be greater consensus about recognizing the realities of climate change, not just in the scientific community, of course, but the public at large. But it seems when you start talking about it as an imminent danger or efforts that should be taken immediately or significantly to change our lifestyle, perhaps compulsory, then people get a little more squishy about it. How do you address that level of skepticism?
Sure. Well, I think that's exactly why we did this report, was to showcase the local impacts using really high resolution climate modeling. So we could go county by county and allow people to see what their extreme heat will look like, you know, mid-century, late century. And I think allowing folks to understand some of those near-term impacts that are right there, you know, in their county, will help underscore the urgency and help people to engage.
And I think it's important, too, for us to think a little bit about human sort of behavior and memory, right? So some studies have come out recently that have shown that people adapt. We're such adaptable creatures. We adapt really well to new conditions. And so actually, it turns out our memory of what normal is really only goes back a couple of years. And so as humans, we're not very good at really remembering some of these aspects of what climate maybe really used to be like in some ways. And so to some extent, we need people, scientists, and politicians who are going to help us create the kind of infrastructure and provide the directions that are going to make the future world just as nice for our children as it is for us.
It seems that we adapt well, but we don't like to have to adapt. That's my unscientific observation. Is that accurate?
Yeah, change is hard, right? Change is always hard and change is scary. And so that is part of some of this. I think the other thing that's important to remember is to put this in a bigger picture context, and that by not reaching out, not trying some of these things, we're actually putting Americans at a bit of a disadvantage, because these approaches come with new technologies, and these technologies are being used in other countries all around the world, in Europe and in Asia. And so if we want to stay on par with what's happening and the adaptation and the green infrastructure that's being implemented in other places, we need to be willing to try a couple of things here and see how they go and give it a shot. And, it'll lead to lots of long-term benefits for us, both in terms of our environment, but also in terms of our place in the technological world.
It seems as though this discussion has had very little impact in the presidential race, for example. Only a few of the candidates have discussed climate change to any degree. Does that concern you, that it's something that's not getting the kind of attention that you both feel it should have?
I think that the national conversation around climate change is still growing. I mean, we did see the recent climate town hall, where a number of candidates did speak out in support of clean energy programs. But yeah, I think this is still a growing movement. In 10 days, there's going to be a global youth climate strike. So things are definitely moving in the right direction in terms of engagement. But there's a lot more we need to be doing quickly to actually reduce emissions and get to renewable electricity much faster. And I think that's where Illinois can really step up. Governor Pritzker has already supported the U.S. Climate Alliance, which would get us to the Paris Climate Agreement levels of climate change, where we're seeing much less of these extreme heat days globally. But we need to take the lead right here in Illinois and, show how it can be done with increasing jobs, increasing investment in communities, and that, wind and solar is not nearly as scary as an extra month of, 105 degree heat.
That was Megan Hassett with the Union of Concerned Scientists and Illinois State University geology professor Catherine O'Reilly with WGLT's Eric Stock. Hassett says advocates hope the state legislature will take up the Clean Energy Jobs Act during the fall veto session. She says the bill currently lacks enough support in the Illinois House. This is the GLT Fall Fund Drive, and we're asking you to make a contribution at WGLT.org to support Sound Ideas, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and all the other programs that you listen to week in, week out. Some news outlets are struggling to make ends meet these days, but not WGLT. Thanks to listener support, we've been able to expand our newsroom and extend our online coverage. We're able to keep you better connected to the stories that matter here in Central Illinois. Instead of working to please shareholders and investors, we work to please you, the listener. This is the public radio model, and it's the reason WGLT is able to bring you independent, in-depth local news. We hope that's worth your support. At WGLT.org. Thank you if you have already contributed this year. You're the reason we are here. If you have not yet given, or it has been a while since your last contribution, keep GLT strong by giving now at WGLT.org. We're ready to offer you just about any contribution payment option you can think of. You can send a check, you can use Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express to make a one-time contribution, or we can bill your credit card or bank account every month. Faculty and staff at ISU can use payroll deduction to support WGLT. We'll make it easy for you, but the important step is yours to take. Go to WGLT.org and contribute. And thanks.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development is celebrating its 25th year. Director Frank Beck and Senior Associate Director Beverly Beyer sit down with WGLT to discuss the program's past, present, and goals for the future. Beck tells WGLT's Mary Cullen the Stevenson Center is the public outreach arm of Illinois State University.
We are that in the sense of service to Bloomington Normal, McLean County, and broader, and the service is through our students.
And that is an unusual model. So many institutions have centers like this, but the fact that there's an interdisciplinary applied curriculum for graduate students is unusual.
Could you explain a little bit about what the overall goal is of the program? Why is it so important to get these students so involved?
So I would say that we're unique in that the education that the students are seeking is the vehicle by which they provide service. And the service they provide is a requirement of the degree program. So different than a standard internship thing, this is much deeper. And the students who find us are, they've already chosen public service as a way of life, as a career for themselves. And with the experience that they come in the door with, they're pretty driven to make a difference at whatever level. I mean, it doesn't need to be large scale change, but it could be, you know, what's happening on my block. And that's what drives them, and that's why they come to us.
And I would say there's just such a great need for leaders in public service. So we know that there's going to be a generational shift occurring with people retiring, and people may not be as maybe drawn to those difficult roles, again, with government and nonprofits. And so we see our role as cultivating those leaders of the future. One of the things that's so wonderful, our students are the best part of the Stevenson Center, and it's just so inspiring to get to work with them when they're here and then to see what they go on to do after they graduate. So we have over 220 alumni at this point over these 25 years, and they're just phenomenal individuals, and they form a really strong network out in the world as well.
So you mentioned over these 25 years, again, the Stevenson Center is celebrating its 25th year anniversary this year. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the roots of the program and where it started.
So Dr. Bob Hunt, emeritus faculty in the Department of Politics and Government, began the program in 1994. It was joint with Western at that time. The focus was on rural communities, and it was specifically designed to bring people back for a graduate degree after Peace Corps service. So Peace Corps fellows were the focus, and the setup of the program with 1 year on campus and then 1 year in the field, that's how it started, and that's the way it's been. And over time, it broadened to include AmeriCorps and AmeriCorps-type experiences in addition to Peace Corps. And so now we have students who come to us with domestic experience and international experience. The center itself has grown. It started with two students. You know, might have had two students in the second year. Now we're at incoming cohort of 12, and we just placed 9 into the field. So at any given point, there's 25 to 30 students in the program, and again, across all those different units. And so it takes a lot of hands to make this work. One of the things that's positive about it is it's interdisciplinary, so it brings together diverse conversations, which is important.
And one thing that's unique for us is that the Peace Corps Fellows Program that Peace Corps started to partner with universities for people coming back from Peace Corps with the idea that they would bring the experience and knowledge that they had from working abroad back to benefit communities in the United States. So that program had existed already. It started with the teachers, education for teachers at Columbia University. But when Bob Hunt started the program here back in 1994, it was actually a partnership with Western Illinois University, and it was the first Peace Corps Fellows program in the country in community and economic development. And so that's, we have a really strong legacy. We are a longstanding Peace Corps Fellows program relative to a lot of other ones that are out there. So really, really rich history.
So we've talked a lot about the changes that have come since the program started in 1994. What do you see as on the horizon? What's the next step or the next level that you're hoping to reach?
So one of the things that we are excited about is that in 2016, we launched the Peace Corps Prep Program for undergraduate students. And so this is a certificate program provided through Peace Corps for undergraduate students who are interested in these kinds of careers in public service. And so it's open to any student in any major across campus. And so that's a growing program here. We're really excited about that. We went through a strategic planning process 2 years ago, and we're every year like knocking off the objectives on that plan. We're going to be working on making some updates to our curriculum this year. We also, one thing that we haven't mentioned is we do provide some direct service to communities and organizations as well. So maybe Frank would like to talk a little bit about that.
So I work with the students on a couple of different projects, but one of the biggest is data management for the courts and the jail. So I teach data management skills to the students. And at the same time, they're providing the service to the county. So you may have heard something about the jail project or something like that. And so that is ongoing since 2010. And as far as I can tell, it's going to keep going. We also work with data management for Illinois Department of Employment Security, a bunch of the different government agencies tied to education, IBHE, ISBE, and that's all sometimes thought of as the boring side of the work, but data management nonetheless. And the students leave ready for data science positions, and so providing service while education, and then they go off to a wonderful career, and I have fun working with them. So
obviously these students are gaining a lot of experience and learning a lot through the program, but also the impact is greater than just the students that are in the program.
Absolutely. So I just want to say too, Frank and I are really lucky to work with a great staff at the Stevenson Center, our program coordinator, Katie Hake, our office manager, Don Dubois. It really is a team effort with all of us and our undergrad interns as well for the Stevenson Center to be a success. So the host organizations really value the ideas that our students bring. So they're bringing fantastic skills in terms of research and program management, and they can be like a breath of fresh air coming into an organization and invigorating some programs or projects that may already be underway. They can be a fantastic resource for getting something new off the ground, for better connecting with the community, with constituents, with really assessing and understanding what's happening. And so organizations that host our students tend to love them. The majority of our students receive an offer to stay on in some capacity, and you know, they may or may not accept that, but we think it speaks really well to the value that they bring to organizations, that that these wonderful partners that we rely on, these organizations, want to keep our students around and have really benefited from having them there.
So much so that they come back. So we have, over time, we've had organizations have multiple students over time, and they wouldn't do that if it wasn't a quality experience for them.
Mm-hmm. So I guess now let's focus on the anniversary itself and the different events that are going on. How are you celebrating these 25 years?
The kickoff is on the 28th. Bob Hunt, the founder of the program, will be inducted into the College of Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame on that day. And we are going to have a series of events over the next 5 days after that will bring in our stakeholders for different events, as well as reconnect us with some of our alumni, so forth.
So it's pretty cool. Our colleague Katie came up with a great idea, which is to celebrate Adlai Week. So our founder, our namesake rather, is Adlai Stevenson II, who obviously was just huge proponent of public service and an exemplar of that. And so we're going to be celebrating Adlai Week, starting with that Saturday, A for act, D for donate, L for listen, A for advocate, I for inspire. And so something cool is going to be happening every day, whether in person or virtually. And we encourage anyone who's interested to check out our Facebook page, look for us at Stevenson Center on Facebook, or go to our website, stevensoncenter.org, to learn more as those dates approach. So we're really excited to celebrate the rich history that we have.
That was WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Stevenson Center Director Frank Beck and Senior Associate Director Beverly Beyer. The Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development kicks off its 25th anniversary Saturday, September 28th.
Whether you realize it or not, the relationships you have with the people in your life are constantly changing. For better or worse, it's a natural part of life. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and there's one relationship you can always rely on, your relationship with public radio. You listen for thoughtful news and conversations, and those only get better with your support. This relationship matters, so please show your support today.
Thanks for listening to GLT. Your support keeps us going, so contribute anytime at WGLT.org.
If you have never contributed during a GLT fund drive, it's time to get on board. Make the decision to financially support WGLT and NPR. Your contribution will help pay for the accurate news and engaging entertainment you depend on. Your contribution will bring us closer to the fund drive goal and help keep fund drive interruptions to a minimum. Don't put it off. This is the WGLT Fall Fund Drive. Contribute now at WGLT.org. Gathering news is never cheap. GLT reporters need more than a microphone and a digital recorder. Transportation, wire services, computers, production studios, engineering support, they're all essentials to WGLT's award-winning local news operation. Covering our community is expensive, but with your help, we can stay on the beat, bringing you the local news, conversations, and feature reports you need and expect. Support your source for local news with your contribution now at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Illinois State University Athletics, encouraging fans to back the Birds as Redbird Volleyball takes on Illinois Friday at 7. It's the season's first event in renovated Redbird Arena. Tickets at GoRedbirds.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are signs of activity in a decades-long effort to clean up an Illinois Superfund site, but it's still unclear when full remediation will occur in central Illinois. Guy Stevens has more.
This started out to be a feel-good story, a follow-up on the plight of Depew. It's a small village west of LaSalle known for its annual speedboat racing championships. It's also home to a Superfund site. A public record of decision and a plan of action for the area was mapped out a couple of years ago, so cleanup work must have begun, right? Nancy Loeb is the director of the Environmental Law Center at Northwestern University, but as far as progress, she didn't sound happy when I called her this summer.
There has been a total failure on the part of both the state of Illinois and the parties responsible for this contamination to move this forward and protect the people of Depew.
Loeb helped the village as it battled ExxonMobil and CBS. They're the owners of a fertilizer plant and an old zinc smelting operation responsible for overlapping waves of contamination in both the town and lake. She and others have also helped Depew as it prodded the state to act in the decades since the site's Superfund designation in 1996. Neither ExxonMobil or CBS would make anyone available or offer a comment for this story, but it was pointed out some progress has been made. When I visited Depew several years ago, the fertilizer plant site, called a phospho-gypsum stack, was found to be leaking toxins into the water table, despite being capped years before. ExxonMobil has just completed recapping the site, and it's hoped that will stop further contamination. Toxins are also flowing into the lake from the old smelter plant. The source is easy to see. As you come around a curve on the road into town, there's a series of bluffs. Imagine a small version of the Indiana Dunes, except for the color, that residents refer to as the Black Pile of Death. That cleanup and of the lake are both years away. But what you don't see has worried residents, too, namely the stuff coming out of the smelter's smokestacks for decades that settled on the land where they and their children lived, worked, and played. Loeb credits Illinois Environmental Protection Agency staff with doing their part in recent years to sort out the technical issues, but Village President Eric Bryant says the problem begins with the Superfund process itself.
The responsible parties are able to drag their feet on too many things, and there's so many rules in that document that, you know, puts them in pretty good control of what goes on.
You get a feel for that when you look at the public documents. The Illinois EPA would offer a list of toxins found in the soil that it said were the results of the plant's operations. The companies, known together as the DePew Group, would counter that these substances were naturally occurring, so exactly what level of contamination required action had to be agreed upon. And if, as they say, football is a game of inches, it has nothing on DePew, the IEPA would say yards should be dug down several feet to remove all contaminated soil. The DePew Group would counter that a foot or less was good enough. Bryant says the state and CBS, which is responsible for the residential cleanup, finally came to a compromise.
If there is contamination below 18 inches, they will stop. They will put down what they call an institutional control. It'd be like an orange fence, and then they would cover it with clean soil. I feel pretty comfortable about it. Of course, I'd like to see it deeper, but, you know, children don't play that deep normally.
Just don't plan on planting a tree or anything else that requires much digging. Most of the village is within a few blocks of the old site, so most, if not all, of its soil is likely affected. But negotiators ended up with a plan to first evaluate each person's yard on a case-by-case process. That brings up the latest point of frustration.
There is a consent order laying out how the properties in town will be tested, and that's going on. There has to be another one, consent decree, agreed upon between EPA and the responsible parties on the cleanup, and that has not been done yet.
Which means, at this point, no cleanup is actually scheduled once testing is completed or even assured. Loeb says she understands the DePew Group's motivations for dragging things out. It's all about the money, she says. But at this point, so close to a resolution, it's an absolute outrage, she says. And that goes for the IEPA and particularly the Illinois Attorney General's office as well.
I am so troubled that these companies, almost 25 years later, have done nothing to clean up the pollution that is affecting people's lives, and that the state of Illinois is not using all of its powers to move this forward now.
The Office of the Illinois Attorney General said it was unable to do an interview for this story, but it did issue the following statement, quote, "The Attorney General's office is committed to having the company remediate the residential properties as soon as possible. We are currently in settlement negotiations with the responsible party that will result in the cleanup of these properties, which continues to be one of our top priorities." Well and good, say the villagers, but after years of such assurances, they're still left asking, when? When can they get on with their lives and begin to look to the future with confidence in the place they call home? I'm Guy Stevens.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. This is WGLT, and it is the Fall Fun Drive here at 89.1 and WGLT.org, and you can make a contribution to supporting the programming that you're listening to on Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. When we interrupt the programming to ask for your contribution, you might think we are just asking for what the station needs. Sure, WGLT has financial needs. We have payrolls to meet and bills to pay like any other business, but we're a not-for-profit business. We really want you to give so we can meet your needs. You need truly balanced reporting on important issues and events. You need solid information on the economy, the environment, and the country's role overseas. You need background and context to help you understand what is happening and how to make good decisions. The only way we can continue to bring you what you need day in and day out is with your financial support. Please contribute whatever you reasonably can right now at WGLT.org. You listen to WGLT so you can better connect to the world around you. Morning edition, all things considered. And yes, sound ideas, they are part of the news service GLT gives you. We also give you Here and Now and 1A to help you understand why things happen the way they do. You get viewpoints from all over the globe and a wide variety of perspectives. The best thing about it all is you get to make up your own mind about the issues and events that matter to you. GLT and NPR give you the facts and the context, and you take it from there. You value this information source? Please support it now with your financial contribution at WGLT.org. What should you pay for programming on WGLT? $10 a month? $5 a week? $1 a day? That's up to you to decide. You get to decide how much you want to contribute to support your public radio station. No matter how much or how little, each and every dollar helps pay for the great news and entertainment you can only find on WGLT. Decide and please donate at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There may be food just free for the taking, but there may also be a few rules you need to observe to be polite and safe. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy and WGLT's Mike McCurdy talk about foraging for food.
Everyone likes free stuff, and free food might be right under your nose. And it might be as simple as thinking about your surroundings a little differently. This is WGLT's Grow, your podcast source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
A lot of food is becoming ripe right now. How hard is it to find some good free stuff just growing out there, free for the picking?
I don't think it's hard at all. And if you're a gardener, plant lover type, as you're moving around this great world that we live in, you know where this stuff is at. It could be berries. It could be potatoes. It could be a number of things that you've just observed, and some of it you can take.
I see apple trees in city parks. Can I just pick those apples?
Well, the short answer is no, because the parks all kind of have the same policy of take nothing and leave nothing. But if you have someone to ask, it never hurts to ask, because you'd be surprised to find a lot of times the answer is yes, like it here at the Fell Arboretum. You might want to ask, too, because there could have been something applied to that tree that you need to have knowledge of. There could have been a pesticide or a fungicide applied.
I see people harvesting blackberries along the Constitution Trail. This is a linear park. Why not just take it if it's going to fall to the ground? And do we have to call regarding the Constitution Trail, do you think?
Well, I think that is a little bit different. And the Constitution Trail is a unique feature here in Bloomington Normal. Not that other towns don't have it. But I think that's a case where that is a foraging opportunity. Nature likely planted those bushes there. And it's not usually useful to leave all the fruit to fall to the ground. Say if you found a cherry tomato growing out behind somebody's house where the seeds were deposited there by nature. That's a case where I think, yeah, you might want to just go ahead and help yourself.
When it comes to the community garden of which I'm a part, there are some rules, but I don't know that everyone knows those rules. What do you think is a good guide for these kinds of spaces, community gardens?
Well, one can harvest from a public or shared garden. If it's a shared plot that's there, you may not be able to utilize it at all. It might be for people that have made a reservation and have kind of staked out a small area in this garden. Community gardens or public shared gardens oftentimes have signage, and it's a clear policy stated that you got to do a little bit of work. You got to pull some weeds. You got to do something other than just showing up and taking everything. And they oftentimes at those gardens have donation boxes and exchange type items where you could either leave something in exchange for what you're taking or log in with a text or an email or sometimes even a written ledger to say, hey, I came here and I edged all the beds, I pulled the weeds, and I took a couple handfuls of cherry tomatoes.
So at my garden plot, I always expected some pilfering, right? So I knew some green tomatoes were going to go missing. I knew some ripe tomatoes were going to go missing. But cabbage is a different thing, right? So I only had six of those.
Oh.
And I had one left, and I was going to do some tacos, and I wanted the cabbage for the garnish for the tacos, and went down, and it was gone.
And you got an unpleasant surprise.
So it was kind of a bummer, but I, you know, you can take stuff, but don't take the last one.
That seems like a good rule, right? If you didn't plant it or you don't know for sure,
don't take the last one.
Yeah.
Black walnuts are seemingly everywhere. I see them on the Constitution Trail. I see them smashed on the street. What about nuts from nut trees? Are those fair game?
Again, that policy is similar to public parks, but we like to tout the Fell Arboretum here at ISU, and we have pecan trees. We have several. We have a couple of enormous ones right in the quad in the center of the university, and I have witnessed people picking the pecans up off the ground. The squirrels get some of them. A lot of them get pushed into earth during mowing the turf, and the rest just go to waste. So I think that that's a great source to draw from, a usable nut product, a little different for the black walnuts, and we can talk about that. But we also have lots of horse chestnut and buckeye trees in the arboretum. Those nuts are collected to grow other trees, but they're really popular as harvest decor. They look great in a big bowl. They look nice in a glass cylinder on a table.
But you don't eat those.
But when you're done using them, you can go and throw them right out in the yard and let the animals and nature have them.
And we'll talk a little bit more about foraging for things that you don't eat. Black walnuts are edible, right?
Yes. I think one has to be very hungry.
Okay.
However.
Are they bitter?
The dichotomy is that the amount of calories it takes to get that salvageable nut is a deficit to what you get, and it's the English walnut that we all love and adore. It's a little easier, and you're not at a calorie deficit in harvesting it.
So the black walnut's edible, but it takes some work to actually get to the nut meat. Any nuts or foods we should be concerned about harvesting from the wild if you don't actually know for sure what you're harvesting? I harvested some wild green onions or chives while camping once, and the person I was with was pretty concerned, kind of freaked out. I was like, well, do you really know what this variety of onion is? And is it edible? I don't know if it's going to kill me, but could it cause some gastrointestinal distress? I think all of those were good points that I hadn't considered. He ate them, assuming that I already knew. He found out afterwards, and we didn't have any problems. But
those are great points. And along with what's been sprayed, has there been anything applied to this plot or to this area? There's another tricky bend in the road there, Mike. So if your gut is not used to eating these naturally occurring foods, you may have some distress, even if it's 100% pure. So I think that if you don't know for sure, which applies to the mushrooms and the fungi that we eat, like the chicken of the forest.
That's the first thing that comes to mind with harvesting wild things and being careful is mushrooms. A lot of them look alike.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really know what you're doing or you could die.
Yeah, that's right. You could. And, you know, so it's easy to separate the morels. So you get your browns and your grays. They look a lot alike, but there are no other mushrooms that really resemble the morel. Same would be true for a shiitake. If you were in, say, Arkansas, where lots of them are cultivated by farmers, by small plot farmers, they're really easy to identify. But so chanterelles are a mushroom that are on the list of what people forage for. But, you know, there are several other mushrooms that have that glossy yellow appearance, and it would not be good to eat them. So if one doesn't know for sure, it's just not worth the chance of taking that risk.
We talked about community gardens. There's also the food forest. And again, you should probably look for posted rules, things like that, to make sure that what you're harvesting is a good idea. But let's talk about things that you forage and don't eat. Hedge apples, are they actually an insect repellent, as I've heard?
I don't know that if there's any scientific evidence.
Okay, so why harvest them?
They look nice.
Okay.
They're interesting. And they just go to waste on the ground. And you don't have to waste them just because you're using them to celebrate the bounty of harvest time in fall. Just like with the nuts, if you do bring them in the house for decor, or you're trying to combat the late season spider deluge that we encounter, you can still throw them back out into the yard, into the property, and kind of return them to the soil forming and food products for the animals.
And you touched on buckeyes, horse chestnuts, acorns, things like that for decorations that you wouldn't necessarily eat. Pine cones might fall into that same category.
Right.
What about firewood?
Firewood is a specially sensitive matter. You can move firewood from one end of town to another and unknowingly carry a pathogen. It could be something as simple as black ants or maybe even termites.
Or it could be the emerald ash borer.
Or it could be emerald ash borer. And you just don't want to move firewood around. Use it where it is created.
Good wood, though? Oak, hardwoods?
Oak's some of the best.
All right. If you have questions about foraging or anything in the garden or landscape, get in touch, and we might answer your questions on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find this and past episodes of Grow at wglt.org. Subscribe to this and all of GLT's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and this is a fund drive edition of Sound Ideas. You know that GLT is much more than a public radio station. We take our website, WGLT.org, seriously because it is serious stuff. No wacky news about goofballs in Florida, no list of 14 pugs that look like Tony Danza, no clickbait. We deliver local news, smart entertainment, and rigorously reported stories from NPR. These are serious times. We bring you serious news. It's time for you to take a serious step to help pay for it. Contribute now at WGLT.org. You've heard the why. Now it's time for the how. Here's how you contribute in the GLT Fund Drive. Call 438-8910 or go to WGLT.org. You'll key in some important information like your name, basic contact information, and how you'd like to pay and what you like about WGLT. That's it. That's the how. At WGLT.org, click on Donate. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible again with listener contributions at, yes, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and Mike McCurdy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.